Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton on the protests in Iran.
We support the universal human rights of the Iranian people. They deserve to have the same rights that they saw being played out in Egypt and that are part of their own birthright.
Secretary Clinton yesterday, as the post-Mubarak Middle East began to take shape with new protests in Iran and elsewhere. Meanwhile, it's still not exactly the summer of love in Egypt, with massive labor strikes to protest wages and prices and questions raised by the fast timetable, almost furious timetable, of the military's plans to hold elections in 6 months and come up with a new constitution for a vote in 2 months. Our next guest is Nancy Soderbergh, who is an assistant to President Clinton for national security. She also represented the U.S. at the United Nations with ambassador rank, working on democracy promotion, among other things. She was involved in the Northern Ireland peace process, and she's the author of The Superpower Myth, The Use and Misuse of American Might, and The Prosperity Agenda, What the World Wants from America and What We Need in Return. She's also been a foreign policy advisor to Senator Edward Kennedy. And according to her Wikipedia page, to Mayor Bloomberg, will confirm that. And she co-chairs the Task Force on Argentinian Debt for American Interests that Want Debt Repayment, and is now with the group the Connect U.S. Fund, which focuses on climate change, human rights, security, and development. Nancy Soderbergh, welcome back to WNYC. Hello.
Good morning.
By the way, have you really advised Mayor Bloomberg on foreign policy?
You know, you should never look at Wikipedia as a source.
That's why I'm asking the question.
Yeah, no, I don't get into that private stuff, but I'm glad to be here this morning and want to talk about Egypt.
And we will talk about Egypt. We will talk about Iran. Is that a no, by the way? You never advised Mayor Bloomberg on foreign affairs?
Just not going to talk about that. I'm here to talk about Egypt.
That's interesting. All right. Mayors don't usually have foreign policies. Maybe he does. Iran, we played that clip of Secretary Clinton. Is this a more full-throated encouragement of the protest movement than we saw from the administration in the summer of 2009 protests?
I think it is. I think you're seeing a sea change in the world that the administration has been playing catch up with. Nobody could have predicted that a fruit seller setting himself on fire in Tunisia would ignite this desire for immediate change throughout the Arab world. And it's probably going to go beyond the Arab world into Pakistan. It's already hit the Persian world. So I think the administration is calibrating as events change. And I think we're trying to get a little bit more ahead of the curve than we were in Egypt.
I'm glad you said Persian. A lot of people don't realize, and I've heard this mistake in the media so many times just in the last week, that Iran, Persia, is not Arab. It's Persian. It's ethnically different. It's not considered Arab, even though it's part of that region. So game this out for us from your experience. The U.S. obviously wants change in Iran, but has been warned against giving the mullahs an excuse to say, you know, this is a U.S.-driven thing or it's playing into the hands of the U.S. I think that was the cause for the restraint in 2009. If you're the Secretary of State, how do you walk that line right now?
Very delicately. If you look at what's happening in Iran today, it's a broadly youth movement, something in the range of 60 to 65% of the population is under 21. They're young. They don't remember the Shah. They don't have animosity towards America. They do have animosity towards the Ayatollah and those who are keeping them from having a normal life. And if you look at what's happening throughout the world, you have a combination of rising living standards, largely youth movements who want a normal life, and they have access to social media, to Google, to Facebook, to CNN, to Twitter. They know what the rest of the world lives like, and they're increasingly saying, why aren't we living like that? And so you had a combination of strong youth movements around the world with social media and educated population, and they're just fed up. Now, it's not going to all play out as it did in Egypt and the rest of the world. Iran has made it clear they'll use violence to quell any uprising. Bahrain was using tear gas. Pakistan is trying to stay ahead of the curve. Jordan is trying to stay ahead of the curve. They're all going to play out differently, but people are the same all over the world, and they all want what we call, in our most recent book, prosperity in terms of their peers. They want to live a little bit better than everybody else, and they're happy. So that's different for every society. But the desire to be free is the same, and people have just had it all across the world.
I want to open up the phones, even though we're going to talk about some other countries as well, particularly for Iranian Americans listening right now. I remember when we did this, Ambassador, in 2009, when that movement was, you know, underway there. And people tended to call up who are Iranian Americans and say, look, the U.S. should really kind of be quiet right now. Let this happen. We hope it happens. We hope the Ahmadinejad regime is overthrown and we get a real democracy in Iran. But better that the U.S. stay out of it. I wonder if this is a different moment in the opinion of our Iranian American listeners. Do you want to see more full-throated embraces of this post-Mubarak wave of demonstrations in Iran, Iranian Americans? 212-433-WNYC. Do you think the United States' role should be different now than it was a year and a half ago? 212-433-9692. And Ambassador Soderbergh, were you critical of the muted response in 2009? And do you think it should be different today than it was at that time?
Well, you have to be careful in that the United States can't dictate what happens in these other countries. If we want democracy, we can invade it like we did Iraq and try and impose it. That's kind of a messy, very expensive proposition, and no guarantees that that in itself will work once we leave. I happen to think Iraq will work. But if you look at what our policy towards Iran has been, we don't have diplomatic relations with them. We haven't since they overthrew our embassy in 79. We deal with the Swiss. But the people know that we're on the cutting edge of what they want. And so the actual population is not anti-American. So our policy has been first and foremost focused on the nuclear project to make sure that they don't get nuclear weapons, trying to impose increasing sanctions on there. And the administration of Iran tries to play that as outside influence. They're trying to pretend that the protesters in the streets are American stooges. And so we have to be very careful not to feed into that narrative. Mm-hmm. And but the people know that we support them, but what does that mean to support them? Are we going to go in and overthrow this regime? No. Are we going to try and have open dialogue and communications with them? Yes. It's interesting, in the last 2 weeks, the U.S. has declared the right to have access to the Internet as a basic human right. I had not heard that before. So now all the world has the right, according to the United States, to have access to free media. They came down strongly against the Egyptians when they tried to turn off access to the Internet. And interestingly, in Egypt, they're now trying to figure out how much that cost. All the businesses in Egypt run on computers like the rest of us. Well, not all, but many of them. You know, hundreds of millions of dollars were lost just in cutting the Internet access off and, of course, the tourism. And so what the United States is trying to do is stand up for the principle of democracy while calibrating the actual involvement in regimes change in each of these situations differently. Oh, they're all different. You can't universalize this.
When you talk about supporting democracy, the U.S. has been for decades on this bubble of choosing between democracy and stability in its foreign policy. But now more commentators are saying dictatorships are the more inherently unstable regime. Look what happened to Mubarak, who we had been supporting. Now you have Musharraf in Pakistan, the former military chief head of state who we supported, now actually under indictment there, I guess, for allegedly having something to do with the assassination of Benazir Bhutto, and there's a democracy movement breaking out. Democracies don't fall, say people like David Brooks, citing the number of 85 dictatorships that have fallen in the last few decades. Do you agree with that assessment, that now the choice between stability and democracy is actually a false choice?
Yes, I do, and I think it's always been a false choice. That deal ended on 9/11, actually. We had a deal with the Arab world for 30 years, which is you give us cheap oil, stable supply of oil, and we'll stay out of your business. That deal fell apart on 9/11. first of all, oil is no longer cheap, and secondly, they weren't stable, and they obviously threatened us. Reform in the Arab world has been something since 9/11 the U.S. government has been trying to push. We didn't know how to do it. George Bush thought that we would invade Iraq and his democracy would blossom all around the Arab world. That did not happen.
But then they also, you know, at least tried to support elections in the Palestinian areas. But then when Hamas won, the Bush administration shrunk from that. So that's an example of how hard it is.
It's an example of how not to do it. You know, you can't push democracy on everyone in that involved in that election that resulted in Hamas being elected. We're telling the administration we're not ready, we're not ready, we're not ready. You can't push it. They made one mistake after another in trying to push a freedom democracy movement. Condi Rice went to Cairo to give a democracy speech and ruined the relationship entirely between the two countries. It did not work. What has worked, and a lot of this isn't always driven from Washington. You have to remember that as the rest of the country rises up and gets rich and educated, they're going to make some of their own decisions, and not everything is going to go through Washington. And this was a spontaneous reaction of pent-up anger throughout the Arab world, but also the world who lives under tyranny. And it's not just Arabs in Saudi Arabia and Egypt and Jordan that we're looking at. Iranians, as we said, are Persian. You've got the Pakistanis we haven't talked about yet. That's going to be very interesting and tricky. And then it goes, obviously, to China, North Korea, Cuba. Now that people see, the more you get information onto how corrupt your own government is while you're living in poverty, that creates an inherent anger in human beings, no matter what country you live in. So as people are shining a light on what's happening in their own government, they understand how other people live. They start questioning, why do we have these dictators and rules that make no sense? And it all impacts their own prosperity of, why can't I make a decent living? And then what set this off was a fruit seller who was tired of the government meddling in his ability to send fruit in the store, and he's just on the streets, and he's just had it. And so all across the world, people are feeling that same anger. And it's a result of kleptocracy, inefficient and corrupt governments denying the right of the people to live their own life. That's partly why the American dream is so strong around the world. They see that we get to live our own lives, that we pretty much make our own decisions, and that we are the biggest, strongest, most powerful country around the world. But what they like is our innovative, our music, our culture, our literature, our art. They want to have the freedom to do that type of expression and to make a living.
Former Clinton-era ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, author of books including The Superpower Myth and The Prosperity Agenda. So on that point, that economic point is so interesting because, you know, we call this a pro-democracy movement. We don't really call it a pro-free market or market liberalization movement. And yet the fall of Mubarak has been followed by, yes, celebrations, of course, but also massive labor strikes, demanding better wages and lower prices, more protests rather than an immediate era of good feeling, it seems, and revolving around economic questions.
Does this surprise you? It's turning into a pro-prosperity movement in every sense of the world. Prosperity, not that everyone wants to drive Rolls Royces, but that they want to provide a decent living for their families. And when corrupt governments that live lavishly deny the ability of the population to do that, you have a seething anger that's ready to erupt, and it just did erupt. And it's going to change the way governments work around the world.
Here's Robert in North Brunswick, originally from Ethiopia. Robert, thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. My question is, looking at what's going on now in Egypt, it's very interesting, but it's very sad to see, the USA did not say anything all along, as far as Mubarak, knowing what kind of regime it is. But now you have Ethiopia, we have a dictator for about 20 years. And America is giving a different kind of support. But why wait until the last minute? And there are a lot of people suffering in Ethiopia right now. I don't mention my name because I'm so afraid that, if I go back and they know about it, then I can be harassed.
Yes, that's why you didn't use your real name on the air. So, Ambassador, he says, why wait till the last minute? So if the deal really should no longer pertain, you know, dictatorship for stability, then why wait until the protesters are in the streets and the dictator's going to fall anyway before the U.S. gets behind and does something like cut off aid?
Well, I'm not sure cutting off aid would promote change in some of these countries. Cutting off aid, putting sanctions on them might create a rallying point for the regime to stay in power longer. That isn't always the way to move forward. Meles, who's been the head of Ethiopia for decades, has, I know Ethiopians, a lot of Ethiopians are friends of mine, and they can't go home. Eritrea is not much better. And we have worked closely with Meles over the years to try and move that country forward and, I think, work with them closely on Somalia. And I think what you'll see after these most recent events is we will push harder for more open, transparent systems than we have before. And that's a good thing. But you've got to remember that the United States, even though we're the most powerful nation on earth, can't wave a magic wand and have these dictators fall all over the world. They wouldn't fall if the United States cut off aid tomorrow. So you need to work with a process of transition in the country, with the United States being more strongly behind it than we have ever been. And I think President Obama understands this. He was consistently, his government was sending mixed messages because they were trying to walk a very fine line of stability versus change.
He was more quiet on Egypt than Bush was, wasn't he, until this broke out?
If you remember, President Obama went to Cairo in 2009 and gave a stunning speech pushing for democracy. He's been ahead of his own government on this since he took office. He consistently said, we have to have change, we have to have change now. And I think he understands that. And I think
other people saw that speech as more of an olive branch to the Muslim world than pushing any kind of democracy change in Cairo.
I think it was both. But if you look at it, it's people want change. They want to move things forward. And I think it was primarily, you're right, it was primarily to try and reset our relationship with the Arab world after the Bush administration. But they have consistently also said it's time to change. Get with this. The 21st century, after all, these countries need to provide for their people and have the people decide their own government.
And it seems to be happening. You've mentioned Pakistan several times. I want to make sure to get to it before we run out of time. What do you think a truly democratic Pakistan would look like? Would it be more anti-U.S.? Would it be more pro-Taliban? You know, we know what a seedbed Pakistan could be, parts of it, with respect to potential terrorism against Americans.
The lack of democracy in Pakistan is driving the extremes in that country who end up allying with the bin Laden and Taliban sympathies, and it's not in the United States' interest. The current government doesn't have full control over its nuclear weapons, its intelligence agencies. The war in Kashmir, the situation in Kashmir has brought them to war three or four times with India. It's an unstable situation. So we need to continue to push that forward. The government of Pakistan is led by Benazir Bhutto's widower, Zardari, who has not had a lot of experience in government. He's struggling to move things forward. I think he's trying, but the government there does not have the pillars of a strong democracy, and it is, I think, the toughest challenge that we face right now. And we're not going to get stability in Afghanistan until there is the same in Pakistan. It's the toughest question, I think.
And it
takes the other one that's to watch is Saudi Arabia. Uh-huh. Saudi Arabia is a house of cards, and if it falls, it's not going to be anywhere near as stable as Egypt's likely to be.
People are saying Saudi Arabia is not going to fall because it's a spread out, physically large country with a lack of concentrated populations in the cities to have big protests like Egypt did in Cairo. Do you disagree?
I don't think it's going to fall tomorrow. I think it's very different. You have to be careful of not equating the two. The Saudi royal family has managed to buy the country's acquiescence in their continued rule because it's extremely wealthy. But if you're not a member of the royal family, you don't have access to the full potential of gaining power and wealth in your own country. And that's a prescription for instability. They've also got serious militants in their own country. It's not an accident that 15 of the 19 hijackers came from Saudi Arabia on 9/11. And it's been in our crosshairs for the United States government to try and push the Saudi government forward. They do not get the message. How it unfolds, it's going to be very interesting to watch and important for U.S. interests.
And, of course, they came to New York on 9/11, so maybe New York City needs a foreign policy. Oh, never mind. Ambassador Nancy Soderbergh, she was an ambassador in the Clinton administration. She's the author of The Superpower Myth and the Prosperity Agenda. She is now with the Connect U.S. Fund, and I very much appreciate your thoughts today. Thank you for coming on.
My pleasure.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, coming up in a minute. A whole new way to look at how we age. Stay tuned.